All right, all you movie junkies, it is time for the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim.
And welcome, one and all, to episode 66 of the SLS Cast. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, we have reached the Mother Road episode. And yes, I'm a poet and I didn't know it. However, the Mother Road, also known as the Main Street of America, also known as the Will Rogers Highway, is indeed, in fact, the legendary U.S. Route 66. And with that wonderful, wonderful pop culture knowledge, I am your de-travoltified host, Matt.
And I am Tim, who's closer to Route 66.
And indeed,
I actually live right off of Route 66, because Route 66 turns into Santa Monica eventually. I believe Santa Monica Pier is technically the end of the line.
That is correct. It is the US 101 alternate in Santa Monica. And as a bonus factoid, Route 66 ceased being an official highway or part of the major system effective my birthday in 1985. Apparently, it was a big deal for me to turn 8. Things happen.
Happy birthday, Matt. We're shutting down America's most treasured highway.
Indeed.
It will not resurface Indeed. Until a Disney animated movie about talking cars comes into fruition.
And see, people say that Disney never does good things, even though it was really a Pixar movie distributed by Disney at the time. At any rate, how have you been doing this last week, sir? Actually, week and a half. Goodness, this is a Friday.
Yeah, we should be actually posting the show right now.
I know. Well, we've had a busy time here in the Houston area due to my spring break happening. So we had my parents come into town. So we're recording on the Friday after, which would be the 14th.
Did you guys go to Mardi Gras?
Of March for
did you guys
anyone who
go,
cares.
Go get
no,
some
we didn't do any Mardi Gras kind no. of stuff. We did a lot of drinking, just not a lot of Mardi Gras stuff. Because there was drinking when they came in on Saturday.
You weren't like flashing each other. Not that
no,
kind of good stuff.
God.
Okay, well, I don't know what the Quintons do. Yeah. I mean, there is a reason why you have more than one daughter.
This is true, but this kind of stuff happens with the spousal unit here. So, now let's see. We celebrated my third place finish in the Idol of the Heights contest on Saturday night after my parents arrived. So we did some drinking then, and then on Sunday we had my daughter's fourth birthday party, and so we did drinking then. And then Monday we went and saw REO Speedwagon at the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo.
Ooh.
In the Directors Club. So there was a ton of drinking then. And on Tuesday, we found another reason. Well, we went to Brenham, and I introduced them to real ice cream out in Brenham. And then when we came home that night, we did the grilling of the steaks and the smoking of cigars and, again, drinking. And then Wednesday, I took them up to the brewery. I took them to St. Arnold's Brewery. So, again, drinking. And, yeah, there was a lot of drinking. I did a lot of drinking. I did ostensibly about 5 months' worth of drinking in 6 days. It was crazy.
Oh.
That's what I did. Along with, I found a really interesting story that actually happened earlier today. Would you like to hear about the ultimate scumbag Stacy?
Sure. Is it Juan
All right,
Pablo
so...
from... Because apparently he's the ultimate scumbag.
No. This is a scumbag Stacy. So for anyone familiar with the world of memes, a scumbag Stacy is a girl who typically in a relationship, you have to either be the in a relationship or the person who ended the relationship in a really crappy way. And this is a pretty ultimately crappy way. This scumbag Stacy sneaks her boyfriend into her bedroom so that they can get it on. And her brother hears the apparently amazing sex sounds or something.
The amazing?
He alerts. They had to have been some kind of out of the ordinary sounds, okay, because the brother alerts the dad. Okay, this takes place here in Houston. It happened earlier in the morning, like at 3 o'clock.
Because that's all you have to do at 3 o'clock in the morning, Houston.
Apparently, yeah. So the brother hears the noises coming from his sister's bedroom, runs and gets dad. Dad is armed and busts into the room and thinks his daughter's being raped. And he says, "Get off my daughter, don't move." And guess what the girl says? Guess what scumbag Stacy says?
I don't even want to guess. What did she say?
She says, and I quote, "I don't know who he is."
Really?
Yes. So the second the guy moved, it looked like he was reaching for something, and the dad shot and killed him.
Wow. How old were they?
And the girl was 16, the boy was 17.
Wow.
I gotta say, that might be one of those weird, ultimately, how the hell do you get here moments as a parent where I would be like, I don't think I have a daughter at this point. Because when your daughter is responsible for you killing somebody that you think is a rapist, that turns out to be her boyfriend because she actually said, "I don't know who this guy is," I think you probably within your rights to maybe
disown her
yeah, for a little while, or perhaps ever. Yeah. I don't know.
Shoot her in the kneecap.
It came up as a news story because the district attorney said that there's probably not going to be any charges.
Really?
Well, because she affirmed the fact that this was a rapist in the middle of the night.
Well, I mean, like, nothing's going to happen to her is what I meant. Like, is she going to be put in detention?
They actually, it's interesting because the story doesn't focus on the daughter at all, just on the guy, on the dad, because he's the one who pulled the trigger. And wow, I mean, good God, how do you? I mean, it's going to go to a grand jury. Don't get me wrong, because all shootings in Texas go to a grand jury because it was, I mean, there was a death involved and everything. But with the castle laws and things of that nature that are in Texas, it doesn't look like he's going to get charged.
Wow.
I mean, just news of the weird.
Yeah.
Caution, don't sneak into your girlfriend's house ever. Good God, ever.
Wow. Yeah, I got a haircut finally. I've been growing out my hair more often, and then finally once I ended up getting a temp job, a regular temp job at a really nice place where I actually have to wear a suit and tie whenever I go there. So I decided to get my hair cut. So I went to a Supercuts nearby, and this is actually the first Yelp review I ever wrote. And I wrote it for the Supercuts because I went there and I've never left getting a trim, looking like a lesbian. And I don't mean that in a wrong way. It's just my hair looked so butch. It looked like a mushroom. I looked like, what's his name? Ethan Hawke from the early 90s. That bad. And the back of my hair was layered like a woman's hair. Like if a woman gets a really short haircut, like a Sharon Stone haircut. You know, it's layered in the back. And that's my weird news about myself from this past week and a half. I got it fixed, kinda, but yeah, it's just like it pisses me. You go in for a trim and you walk out looking like Ellen DeGeneres. It's not fun at all. Bluebell homemade ice cream.
I'm both sorry to hear that and amused at the same
yes.
time.
yeah.
Good times. Good times.
Yes.
All right. Well, I guess you want to jump into the news?
I believe it's about that time.
Then let's jump into it, folks. Here we go. The news.
Gonna poo.
All right, first up for me, from Variety.com, courtesy of Justin Kroll, Star Wars Adam Driver to play the villain. This is an exclusive. It turns out that Adam, the girl's actor, Adam Driver, is close to signing on to play the villain in J.J. Abrams' Star Wars Episode 7. Exact details are unknown, but the character is said to be in the vein of iconic Star Wars villain Darth Vader. Now, I have not heard of this guy, but I mean, I looked at his picture here that they provided for us. The Variety was kind enough to provide. And he looks creepy enough that he could definitely play a villain. Now, you say that, you, Tim, when we were talking about this, you said that he does some kind of
Gap ads.
Weird commercial.
Yeah, I think it's for Gap. It's not necessarily commercial, it's billboard ads. And Yeah, it's mainly ads, and it just looks. I don't know really how to explain it. I don't know. He looks like one of those shifty guys that belong in the shadows.
Well, I guess the shadows make the dark side, they do. Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah, let's do that. All right, well. What do you got,
sir? All right, so this is a Hollywood Reporter article. The article is entitled, Google Warns Muslims Ruling will create Hollywood chaos. According to Google, the ruling opens the doors to an extra in even Gone with the Wind, contacting Netflix and demanding that it purge every copy of the film from its inventory. Google is really freaking out about Wednesday's ruling, determining that Innocence of Muslims actress Cindy Lee Garcia could assert a copyright interest in her performance in the film, and that as a result, the controversial anti-Islamic film had to be wiped from YouTube. And this is the one that kind of stirred, Innocent of Muslims, or whatever it's called, is the, it stirred up a lot of controversy because of the portrayal of, like, Muhammad, I believe that's correct. Here a year and a half or a year or two ago, you know, not too long ago, but it was just, it's crazy. And they were saying that I don't know if it's really that big of a deal, but hell, I mean, these people even got mad at South Park for portraying Muhammad in a cartoon. Anyways, the article continues on. The web giant has filed a new emergency motion to stay the deposition pending a rehearing before a larger panel at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. In doing so, Google has some bold First Amendment warnings about the implications for allowing an actress with 5 seconds of screen time to enjoin its distribution of Innocence of Muslims. And this is quoting, I guess, Google. The panel has adopted a novel interpretation of the copyright law that will invite uncertainty and chaos for the entertainment industry, documentary filmmakers, amateur content creators, and for online hosting services like YouTube, allowing bit players in movies, videos, and other media to control how and when creative works are publicly displayed. How so? Google continues. Under the majority's analysis, absent contractual shifting, movie actors could register copyrights in their reaction shots, facial expressions, and mimed chatter. Background singers on a record could register their oohs and ahs. The list goes on. Now, could the ruling be the end of YouTube? This is what Google says. Most of the millions of amateur filmmakers who upload their videos and other creative works to YouTube presumably do not have written agreements with those who appear in their videos. That means anyone who appears in those videos, even for 5 seconds, will now have independent authority to contact YouTube and demand their removal. And the article goes on from there. But I'm going to jump to this other article that was just released here a couple days ago from The Hollywood Reporter. And this one's called Innocence of Muslims Battle Copyright Registration denied. And they say that soon after the ruling by Ninth Circuit Chief Judge Alex Kozinski, Google filed an emergency motion to stay the order pending a rehearing on bank. Judge Kozinski denied the motion, but in rare move, that illustrates the tensions this decision was wrought. Another Ninth Circuit judge made a sua sponte, or spont request, to have the circuit reconsider the stay. 19th Circuit judge voted against a stay rehearing, leaving open the possibility of a rehearing on the overall case. For now, YouTube will still need to remove innocence of Muslims. Now, both sides have filed briefings on the issue, with Google revealing the latest. The U.S. Copyright Office has refused Garcia's attempt to register a copyright. And if that's not enough, on Wednesday, Facebook, Twitter, IAC, and Pinterest requested permission to file media groups and publishers, including the New York Times, Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, are also weighing in support of Google. Giving an actor a copyright in his or her performance possibly opens a can of worms when it comes to works of authorship like movies and television shows that contain contributions from many individuals. Some in Hollywood shrug off the doomsayers, saying of the practice of studios getting signed release forms from actors, which Garcia didn't have when she was cast in what she believed to be an innocent adventure film titled Desert Warrior. That's what the movie was originally called before Innocence of Muslims. And then there are those like SAG, AFTRA, pleased that an appeals court has recognized actors' rights. And this article goes on as well. Both great articles. People should definitely check them out and look into the subject. Matt, what do you think? Do you think this is utterly ridiculous? And the only reason why SAG and AFTRA, I'm just going to say this real quick, are siding with the actors is because they'll be getting more money. You know, these are the acting unions. You know, they'll be getting more money from actors, you know, being involved with background actors, being involved with some kind of like copyright issue with their performances.
Yes, I believe this is completely ridiculous. However, it is kind of nice when the little guy gets to strike a blow that shows how ridiculous the big guy is. With all of the with all of the increasing ridiculousness that is copyright, that is literally anyone who automatically puts anything out there and puts it in an original format, whether or not they formally register it, is automatically copyrighted for 70 years, up until 70 years after they're dead. Now, you do have to go through a little bit more work to prove that if you don't formally copyright it. However, you still have a legitimate claim to copyright, is just showing you how ridiculous it's actually getting. And yet, at the same time, you do really have to draw the line somewhere. And I think, extras getting full copyright status claim, and image rights and everything.
Yeah, and it says, like, people, the background chatter. You're not actually chattering, you know, chatting or whatever. Whenever you're in the background, you're miming.
You're miming conversation.
Yeah, so exactly. You're going to copyright your lip movement. It's ridiculous. I mean, are you going to start copywriting if like the news, if CNN or you know, nightly news?
What if somebody was miming though a copyrighted work, like they had memorized a play and then began. Like Death of a Salesman, and then they just started running through the dialogue, and then they could say, ooh, it's a copyright violation. That's a copyright violation. That guy is actually miming the words to Death of a Salesman.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I mean, and I'm an actor, really? And I know how hard it is to get jobs and stuff in California, even non-acting jobs, but especially acting jobs, because there's so much competition. I don't know. I think it's just pure laziness. I mean, if people aren't going to get noticed one way, they're going to find another way to get noticed. Now, you know, despite how stupid and utterly ridiculous they have to stoop down, or how utterly ridiculous of a low level to stoop down. There you go.
All right. Well, then let's move on to the next one here. I've got another one from Variety.com, courtesy of Todd Spangler. Disney to spend $200 million on Marvel series for Netflix. and also here set to film in New York. Yes, folks, the Walt Disney Company will spend $200 million over 3 years filming 4 series based on Marvel's Street Heroes characters in New York City for Netflix, the biggest TV or film production commitment in the history of New York State, officials said. Disney Chief Bob Iger and New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, at a joint press conference today, and by today, this was, a few days ago, announced that Marvel's landmark live-action television series will film principally in the Big Apple, which will mean that the production is expected to yield 61-hour episodes, resulting in 400 full-time jobs and 3,000 part-time jobs. This is just one prong in the multi-prong deal that Disney has for the Marvel series, which was announced last fall and followed a larger output deal that the company struck in late 2012, which includes exclusive pay TV window rights for films starting in 2016. Under that pact, Netflix will be the exclusive U.S. subscription TV service for first-run movies from Walt Disney Studios, including titles from Disney, Walt Disney Animation Studios, Pixar Animation Studios, Marvel Studios, Disney Nature, and Lucasfilm. So basically, come 2016, everything Disney's ever done and is going to do is going to be available via Netflix. Take that, cable companies! This is exciting. I'm glad to see that they're really moving forward on this and that there's actually going to be there's now production commitment coming. And moreover, there could be really good movie potential going forward. And I know that as of last episode, you were all marveled out. But I just really hope that this will start opening the door for more heroes or new interesting superhero types or maybe indie things to start happening. Because while now it's not necessary to bring every single Marvel superhero to the big screen, they are channeling them to other viable options like Netflix, and therefore opening up the doors to put other things on the big screen. And I don't know, I think this is pretty cool. I think this is a great thing overall. What do you think, Senor?
Well, why not? I mean, they have the audience, so where there is a want, or, you know, they will supply it. And superheroes are kind of the hot thing right now, and I don't really see it dying off anytime soon. Unlike zombies, I think zombies hit their peak a year or so ago, and those are dying off. But I think superheroes will always stay because there's such a deep rooted fan base for them. So I think it's kind of cool. I mean, I'm enjoying watching Netflix evolve. And about Netflix, Matt, I don't know if you've... I'm sure you probably know this, that Netflix in Canada, they have different programming or they have different stuff on Instant in Canada. Well, I got a glimpse into Netflix Canada, and they have so many different movies than here. It is ridiculous. Like, they have Before Midnight streaming on Netflix. They have... Just a lot of World War Z, just like a whole bunch of brand new movies. So I mean, they're talking about how, like, in Canada, I think they don't even have half the number of movies that we have here in America, but their programming is better. And I think doing all, like, securing the rights to Disney movies or Marvel movies or whatever, it'll kind of even things out a bit, I guess, between their audience. I think it's kind of cool.
Cool, very cool. All right, what do you have, sir?
Okay, so the movie Frozen, speaking of Disney, Idina Menzel, Kristen Bell, Josh Gad, even, won the Academy Award for Best Animated Feature Film at the Academy, well, obviously, the Oscars a couple weeks ago. And recently, it just crossed the $1 billion mark worldwide. And it's widely popular for the most part. A lot of people enjoy it. But apparently, there are two lads in Colorado. It's a discussion-type Colorado-based radio show. Its co-hosts are Steve Vaughn, and I don't know the other guy's name, unfortunately. Anyways, this is from another Hollywood Reporter article, and these two guys didn't care for Frozen. In fact, they claim that this Disney film indoctrinates homosexuality in bestiality. And I think I failed to mention also that I believe this Steve Vaughn this one of the co-hosts, Steve Vaughn, is a pastor. Yes, and he highlights the film's progressive agenda in this little soundbite.
Man, how many children are taken into these things, and how many Christians are taking their kids off to see the movie Frozen, produced by an organization that is probably one of the strongest, most pro-homosexual organizations in the country. You wonder sometimes, I'm not a tinfoil hat conspiratorialist, but you wonder sometimes if maybe there's something very evil happening here, Steve.
It makes you wonder.
It makes you wonder, yeah. I mean, if I was the devil, you know, what would I do to really foul up an entire social system and do something really, really, really evil to 5 and 6 and 7 year olds and Christian families around America?
I think I would make a movie.
I would buy Disney.
Yeah.
If I was the devil, I would buy Disney in 1984.
Yeah.
And that's what I would have done.
And then you start making all these nice little movies that just throw little things in there that make sin look enticing. And in fact, some of the worst of sins make it look enticing, or at least to start to indoctrinate slowly. Turn the heat up on the frog in the pan.
Friends, this is evil. Just evil. I wonder if people are thinking, you know, I think this cute little movie is going to indoctrinate my 5-year-old to be a lesbian or treat homosexuality or bestiality in a light sort of way. I wonder if the average parent going to see Frozen is thinking that way. You know, I wonder if they're just walking in and saying, yeah, let's get my 5-year-old and 7-year-old indoctrinated early. Steve, you know they're not.
No.
I think for the most part, they're oblivious. And yet, maybe they do pick up on pieces of it, but they just don't get up and walk out.
The two argue that the film indoctrinates kids at a younger age to be open to homosexuality as well as bestiality. Since Jonathan Groff's character Kristoff has an unnatural relationship with his animal, Sven, Swanson noted that Disney altogether is leading the charge to the sewers of Sodom by threatening to pull funding for the Boy Scouts of America for their anti-gay policies. And they continue pulling dialogue from the show. I got a lot of things from Frozen, but I really didn't get the indoctrination of homosexuality as, like, you know, in the forefront of what they're trying to promote in that movie. Wow. It's a little fruity in the booty.
Well, I gotta say that, Tim, the problem here is that you have been missing out on a very, very active watchdog group, and they resurface every so often into the major news networks and come to the national conscience only every so often. But they are the group of people who read way the fuck too much into shit. Now, it's a very select group of people, and I've got to say, I think the reverend here, the good reverend, is the chairman of the people, of the group of people who read way the fuck too much into shit. And it's just nice to see that they're still there, reading way the fuck too much into shit.
And one more thing, is that the co-hosts also cite Policy Mike's Progressive Moments Roundup in a National Catholic Register blog post that outlines, I'm reading this from the Hollywood Reporter, that outlines the film's homosexual undertones. Elsa is born that way, and after she outs herself during her coronation, she accepts who she is via the coming out anthem of Let It Go, never entertains a male suitor, and then becomes part of Disney's first feature same-sex couple. A short after the end credits shows the giant, male-voiced snow monster wearing Elsa's crown.
I don't know. It's dumb. That's all I have to say. Fucking idiots. Next up for me, though, from Collider.com, courtesy of Am Chit... I'm sorry, Am? Good Lord, I'm just on top of it today. All right, coming to us from Collider.com, courtesy of Adam Chitwood. Ralph Fiennes says Bond 24 starts filming in October. Not only did he tell that to MTV News, but we also know that Daniel Craig will return, and that it is assumed that Naomi Harris, a.k.a. Moneypenny, will be back as well. Unfortunately, the cinematographer and all-around master Roger Deakins will not be returning for the follow-up. So, good news on that front. I'm looking forward to the next Bond film, and that is all.
All right, so I'm going to bring back my little mini news segment called Do We Really Need This? Or I should probably add, Do We Really Need This Fucking Shit? Because it's, I mean, this is news that I don't know. I mean, it highlights remakes, redos, the transition from movies to musical, Broadway stage shows, and I just some of this stuff really gets me. One of them here is a movie from my childhood that I always enjoyed watching on cable, whenever it would come on, usually on a Sunday, was the movie Explorers, about the boys and the spaceship go onto that one big-ass spaceship, and they meet the monsters and all that. It's really goofy and fun, a little dated now. Well, apparently Paramount is thinking, or actually they're already planning to remake the movie Explorers. They're actually planning on remaking it. Why? I don't know. Because the movie is good, you know, how it is. It stars Ethan Hawke, River Phoenix, Jason Preston. It was directed by Joe Dante, who made his name with directing The Gremlins and The Howling. In other Do We Really Need That Shit news, Jason Sudeikis is in talks to star as Fletch in Fletch 1. Yes, a remake of the Chevy Chase classic. Well, not necessarily a remake. I mean, it's, you know, a sequel or whatever. Based on novels by Gregory MacDonald. So, I mean, they're mystery novels, so I guess that makes sense. But still, I guess I just really don't like Jason Sudeikis, you know, all that much. And lastly, Pretty Woman. You know, it's falling in the lines of Rocky. You know, whenever I think of Rocky, I think of Broadway musicals. And that's apparently what people, you know, when they think of Pretty Woman, they think of Broadway musical. And it turns out that Pretty Woman is going to be a Broadway musical. It's in the works. Again, this has kind of been a thing for a while now. Yeah, so Matt, do you think any of this makes sense? Or should this... Is it because we've just run out of books to adapt?
No. No, as a matter of fact, it's not that. It's not. It's quite the opposite. It's because we have not run out of things to exploit and remake and redo. That is why. Anyway, fun times, I know. There's more coming. I'm sure there is. Next up from IGN.com, courtesy of Scott Kulura. We've heard about a return to the world of The Matrix on the big screen here and there over the years, but now a report indicates that Warner Brothers and series creators, the Wachowski siblings, are moving ahead on a new trilogy in the series. Latino Review has the scoop, saying that the Wachowskis have started the writing process and have turned in treatments and outlines to Warners. It's not clear whether or not they'll direct the films if they actually come to pass. Also not clear whether or not Keanu Reeves or any original cast members will return. LR does say one of the early outlines is about the birth of the Matrix, which would predate Neo. This is all very early in the process, obviously, and that's assuming that LR's sources are even correct. But if they are, which they usually are, is a return to the Matrix in order?
Only if the Wachowskis direct.
Are you kidding? Did you see the last two Matrix films?
Yeah, the second one didn't bother me too much. The
okay.
Last half of the
Fair
third
enough.
Ones
were. All right, what else you got?
You know, but like, they did Cloud Atlas. And I'm really looking forward to Jupiter Ascending, and you know, I dig them. I even enjoyed Speed Racer, for all that matters. All right, so 2016 May 6th. To be exact, I believe that's a Friday. It's got to be, because that is when the new Batman Superman movie will be released. Well, Marvel has had that day marked down and saved for the opening of whatever Marvel movie that they were, you know, that they're planning on opening on that day. And even though Batman Superman announced that they were going to be opening that day, despite Marvel always opening usually that weekend, that's technically the first weekend of summer, or something like that, Marvel is still persistent on not moving from that spot. It's, you know, they've been doing it forever. You know, they deserve it. It's kind of like the old people going to eat at Luby's. You know, they always have that one spot, and the manager just, you know, make sure they always accommodate them to that one spot. It's right next to the Jell-O pudding. Well, it turns out it's going to be Captain America 3, and since Captain America the Winter Soldier has been getting, or been receiving rave reviews, it'll be quite interesting to see how these two battle it out that weekend. I mean, I have no idea. I didn't care for Man of Steel, so I don't know really what direction the sequel will take, but it should be pretty interesting. I'm kind of excited to see what'll happen. I mean, I'm sure one of them might end up, maybe even Batman and Superman might end up switching weekends, because, yeah, it's going to be one colossal action-packed superhero mega weekend.
I will more than likely end up seeing both movies, so I guess neither one wins. They just tie.
Well, one thing we do know for sure is that they probably will both be about 2.5 hours long. So plan on spending about 8 hours of your life sitting in a movie theater that weekend.
From the NewYorkTimes.com, courtesy of Paul Vitello, Hal Douglas, 89, superstar of movie trailer narrators, dies. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, Hal Douglas, a voiceover artist who narrated thousands of movie trailers in a gravelly baritone, heard by audiences everywhere, as he might have put it, thrilled by images never before seen, until now, died on Friday at his home in Lovettsville, Virginia. He was 89. The cause was complications of pancreatic cancer, his daughter Sarah Douglas said. Mr. Douglas was known for a generation in the voiceover industry as one of the top two or three go-to talents, along with Don LaFontaine, the most prolific, who died in 2008, and Don Morrow, the voice of the Titanic trailer. His dramatic range, from Olympian Thunderous to Comic Goofy, suited him for trailers for movies as diverse as Philadelphia, Forrest Gump, Coneheads, Meet the Parents, and Lethal Weapon. Also, the under 17 not admitted without a parent. This guy, it's just kind of sad. We've lost, literally, along with Don LaFontaine, who we lost back in 2008, we're losing part of the old guard. And it's just really kind of sad for me, because someone who has such a love and respect for the growing up of Hollywood and the change and all of the stars, it just kind of seems like we're running out of talent, truly iconic talent, to replace the ones that are outgoing. And I know that there are always going to be more, and that there are going to be people who are going to come, and there's going to be like that kid last year who's like 14 or something and wants to be a voiceover artist, so he put a little thing on YouTube, and then he ends up going viral and getting on Ellen and everything like that. So I mean, there are going to be more people who come and go and to replace. It's just kind of sad. I don't want to let go, and that's kind of where I fall on that. So R.I.P. Hal Douglas. R.I.P.
D. Not. All right, so I guess I will wrap up my news real quick with Batmobile news. Well, first off, I guess the happier of the news, least likely to piss somebody off. Apparently there is a replica of the Tumbler, the Christopher Nolan Batmobile version or whatever. For $1 million, a replica will go on sale for that much money. Drivable, I don't know. God, talk about one epic alarm system that motherfucker has got to have. But it's $1 million. In other Batmobile news, so going back to the Ninth Circuit here, another THR article, does Warner Brothers own the Batmobile? They say that this summer the Batmobile will roll into a federal appeals court with James Bond, Godzilla, Freddy Krueger along for the ride. Freddy Krueger along for the ride. The Ninth Circuit is poised to consider whether Batman's car is a character protectable under copyright law. Arguing against that idea is Mark Towle, a Temecula, California mechanic, who in 2011 was sued by Warner Brothers, DC Comics, for selling replicas of a Batmobile from the 1960s TV show and 1989 film. Towle is appealing a rule that says that he is liable for infringement. He argues that the Batmobile is merely functional, a useful article, legal speak for a utilitarian rather than artistic object. If the court sides with Warner Brothers, Hollywood studios would win a powerful weapon to stop products that are similar to props like lightsabers and ruby slippers. Licensed merchandise accounts for $150 billion in annual worldwide sales, and studios traditionally have relied on trademark and trade dress laws, which protect against consumer confusion. to police knockoffs. And this article goes on and talks a little bit more about that. But yeah, I thought that was pretty interesting. If this goes through, you know, when you go to the concerts or even the rodeo, you know, kids won't be able to get those little light thingies because they look too much like a lightsaber. Less like a light. Period. A light, light. That just is used to light. I wonder, like, the people that kind of walk up and down in the movie theater, the ushers with their little cone lights, can they get sued? Because that kind of looks like a lightsaber, I wonder.
Another crazy copyright claim. Oh my goodness, who knew? Who knew? All right. Well, I guess that concludes the news and allows us to now go to our next segment, which is, did it age well? That's right, ladies and gentlemen. We don't have anything special to introduce this, so I'm sure Tim will
did
figure
it
something
age
out.
Well?
Anyway, or nothing, and you're just going to hear this kind of funny thing, and that's going to be okay, too. All right, so our movie, the thing we want to do for Did It Age Well is we have a rule. It's got to be at least 20 years old. And we kind of sort of cheated on this one because it definitely eked in. It came out February 4th, 1994. So it is over 20 years old. And it was the movie that launched Jim Carrey's career. On a budget of $15 million, made $107 million box office. And it is, of course, the 1994 comedy detective film, directed by Tom Shadyac and written by Jim Carrey. Well, actually, screenplay was by Jim Carrey, Tom Shadyac, and Jack Bernstein. So let's not... based on a story by Jack Bernstein. It starred Jim Carrey, Courtney Cox, Sean Young, Tone Loc, and Dan Marino. Yes, folks. It did ultimately spawn a sequel called Ace Ventura, When Nature Calls, as well as a direct-to-video spinoff, Ace Ventura, Junior Pet Detective, and an animated series. So let's just say this was a pretty big deal. And for those who don't know what Ace Ventura is about, and I'm not sure how you couldn't, but for those who don't know what Ace Ventura is about, this is about a very eccentric and oddball, goofy dude named Ace Ventura, who is, of all things, a pet detective. And due to a terrible plot by an unknown criminal mastermind, the mascot of the Miami Dolphins is stolen 2 weeks before Super Bowl to shake up the Dolphins' chances of winning said Super Bowl. And who gets put on the case? Ace Ventura gets put on the case. And it's, of course, extremely funny because he is actually a really good detective, but his methods are inherently laced with madness. Not even laced. They're just out-and-out madness. What do you think, Tim? Do you think that this film aged well?
Surprisingly, yes. I mean, really, to me, the only thing that... I mean, the music, the very early 90s goofy comedy action suspense music, and some of the costumes are what dates the movie. And I think watching it now, I realize that Jim Carrey kind of overdoes things just a little too much at the beginning. But in fact, there's actually some really good performances by him in this movie. And I just never realized, like, actually how good the story is. And even the twist at the end. And it's just a well-made movie. And I think this movie just kind of helped pave the way for, well, Jim Carrey especially, but also Tom Shadyac, of being able to make these slapstick comedies, but they can actually be good to watch. You know, there's actually a story to it that you can actually enjoy in some way. And you're not just watching Jim Carrey over-exaggerate every single thing he says over and over and over again. There's more to it. And so I'm actually really glad that you wanted to do this, because it's very entertaining. And it brought me back to a happier and simpler time of my life, particularly my childhood, whenever I was, well, I guess, was 6 or 7 when this movie came out. And I remember watching it and just thinking, God, man, Jim Carrey is a fantastic actor. You know, he's so good. And growing up, I look back like, man, I thought, I mean, there's Tom Hanks, there's, you know, Al Pacino, there's Robert De Niro. And I thought as a kid that Jim Carrey was a great, one of my favorite actors. But then, you know, as I grew up, you know, Jim Carrey ended up doing Truman Show, The Majestic, Man in the Moon, the Andy Kaufman movie. And, you know, he's actually proved that he is a fantastic actor. But then also watching Ace Ventura here, he does a pretty good performance. I mean, he plays a good character. Though it is, I mean, I'll say it again, though he does overdo it quite a bit at first, but there is just pure comedy gems in this movie. Like whenever he returns from being in the dolphin tank, and I forget what he says, but he just like slaps the pocket on his shirt and all that water just squirts out. Hilarious stuff like that. Just, it's just good. It's fantastic fluff compared to some of the crap that comes out now.
I will definitely have to say that I do agree with you. I thought that while, of course, the music's going to be a little bit dated, and yes, some of the costumes are also dated, it is a 20-year-old movie. That I was totally willing to forgive. I was really trying to look at source material in terms of the comedic actions that were done, be they physical or just trying for the one-liners or what have you. And then, of course, plot points. For me, I thought that the vast majority of this stuff was great. Comedically, he was really good, especially with the whole Mission Impossible theme section. Or another good one is when he goes to the mental institution there. That's actually my wife's favorite scene of the whole movie.
Melissa, it's Ace.
Ace, what are you doing here? It's the middle of the night.
You have to commit me. Finkel escaped from Shady Acres in Tampa. They still have some of his stuff.
Ace, they're not just going to let us waltz in and look around.
I know. It's a good thing I'm a master of disguise.
Mrs. Robinson, I'm Dr. Handley.
Hi. Right.
Now, who is it that you'd like us to have a look at?
My brother, Larry.
I'm ready to go in, Coach. Just give me a chance. I know there's a lot riding on it, but it's all psychological. Just got to stay in a positive frame of mind. I'm going to execute a button hook pattern super slow-mo. See that in an instant replay.
There were really very few dated jokes. So there was like a love connection reference and a love boat reference, for example. And there are things, so those kinds of things were dated, but they were very, very far and few between. And I really think that based on the context of the jokes themselves, I thought that was really funny. And I really think that if the target audience then, basically guys, if you watched The Hangover, and then of course teenage dudes and whatever, teenagers and stuff, would also think that this movie is really funny today. And I have to agree, this movie did age well. And I had a lot of fun. It was nice to kind of have an excuse to go back and watch this movie. Because, you know, I don't do people. I only do animals.
Did you watch it with your folks?
I did. We actually watched it last night.
Okay. Did they enjoy it? Have they seen it before?
My mom actually went with me and my brother to go see this movie in the theater. And she was literally ashamed of herself for how much she loves this movie.
Really? Oh, that's great.
Yes, because she thought, you know, of course it's all crude humor and everything. And she thought that she was going to hate it and that she should hate it. But no, she loves it.
Yeah, I just love Jim Carrey whenever he's, or when Ace is analyzing the motive and whatnot in front of everybody and kind of like explaining, you know, the plot or the mystery. and just, you know, showing off.
Roger Pitt actor, when Roger Pitt actor gets killed.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's just, it's so funny. And it's so well written, I thought. And that, I guess that's what I meant about how good of an actor he is, because, you know,
well,
it's
sure,
over
and
the top.
I also thought that they provided those scenes. That's good writing,
yeah,
to progress the movie. And like, just like when he's got the wrong lead at the beginning, but he works out though that he has a solid clue that will eventually lead him to where he needs to go. And then of course he has the one buddy, just like in any good detective movie, he's got the one buddy at the cop, you know, at the police department, who is his friend but still doesn't want to really be seen with him at the police department. Then of course he's got his one buddy that is kind of the underground guy who helps him get leads and stuff. I mean, you see that they're very good tropes that follow good detective stories, and they are here as well. And I think that's, again, something that helps the movie age well. So I'm definitely, yeah, I'm glad we are in agreement that this movie has aged well.
May I tell you what I think happened? Alrighty then. Roger Pedactor went out after work. He had a few drinks and he came home, but he wasn't alone. Someone else was with him in this apartment. There was a struggle and he was thrown over that balcony. Roger Pedactor didn't commit suicide. He was murdered.
Well, that's a very entertaining story, but unfortunately, real detectives have to worry about that little thing called evidence.
Uh-oh. I think I heard a toilet flush. Maybe somebody lost a turtle.
Well, I guess I'm a little out of my league here. Einhorn, good work.
Ooh.
Oh, there is just one more thing, Lieutenant. This woman is Roger Pedactor's neighbor. She lives across the hall. She said she heard a scream. Is that right, ma'am?
Right.
And you said you had to open the balcony door when you keyed into the room?
Yeah, that's true.
You're certain you had to open this door?
Yeah, I'm certain.
What's the point, Ventura? Only this.
This is double pane soundproof glass. There's no way that neighbor could have heard Pedactor scream on the way down with that door shut. The scream she heard came from inside this apartment before he was thrown over the balcony, and the murderer closed the door before he left. Yes! Yes! Oh, yeah! Can you feel that, buddy? Huh? 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 I have exorcised the demons. This house is clear.
I guess that's the shortest segment we've ever had. All right, well then let's go ahead and do the last one. Here we go. The movies. Yes, the movies. The movies for this week were Prince Avalanche, 300, Rise of an Empire, and Mr. Peabody and Sherman. Where do you want to start, sir?
Let's go with Prince Avalanche.
Okie dokie. Prince Avalanche, 2013 comedy drama starring Paul Rudd and Emile Hirsch, directed by David Gordon Green. And, yeah, this is a, basically, two, it's not brothers, they are... It's a guy, and then his, I guess you could say, would-be brother-in-law, because it's the brother of his girlfriend. They are responsible for re-striping the roads through a national forest that had burned in Texas. And this movie takes place in 1988, and it's basically, they are two completely different people with two completely different outlooks on life, who kind of bond over the events of a week during this time. You go ahead and start, Tim. Tell me what you thought.
Some positive things about it. I like the idea. I really like the idea. I like the uniqueness of it. I like the setting a whole lot. The movie had some great moments with between Paul Rudd and Emile Hirsch. I thought whenever they were, I thought their performances were really, really well. I particularly liked Emile Hirsch more so than Paul Rudd. Paul Rudd really didn't grow on me, his performance, more until a little bit at the beginning, but then like more so midway and then towards the end, whenever he's just kind of like left alone in his own atmosphere doing his own thing. But with saying that, I thought the movie was a little tried a little too hard in attempting to create a particular tone by using like really trippy music as a backdrop to these various montages. And the guy from the band Explosions in the Sky provided the music. It creates a surreal, dreamlike atmosphere. And I like what they were doing, kinda, but I just thought that the music that they were using and kind of what they were going for, it happens too much throughout the movie. But it also contradicts the tone and the setup, you know, that the two actors have already spent however long building up during the course of the movie. You have the relationship between the two, but then with the music and the montages, you don't really get that comedic buildup. And I didn't really particularly find this movie funny at all. I didn't really have the witty humor. Instead, it kind of had gross out humor in a way, or on the verge of gross out humor. Like their fart jokes, you know, they talk about blowjobs, fingering, you know, just fooling around stuff, whatever. But it just didn't play out as I originally expected it, and how I would have wanted to. It just felt too like it was trying too hard to be something that it was not, or that it really had no chance of ever becoming, because of how they established the movie at the beginning. You know, it starts off a tragedy because the woods have burned down, and it also doesn't help when Paul Rudd is left alone when Emile Hirsch goes off for the weekend. He goes in town to go sleep with a girl, whatever. Paul Rudd visits these houses that were burned down during the fire, and I mean, I'm not really giving anything away. I guess maybe I am, but I'm going to give it away anyway. He goes to the house that's burned down, a house that's burned down. He sees a woman that's picking up random objects, and he goes and talks to her. And he did, I mean, this is an excellent scene. I mean, my favorite scene out of the entire movie. He goes and talks to her, and the woman just starts, she's, you know, it's her house that burned down. She's holding up stuff, and she's trying to find a particular belonging, you know, a piece of paper. I forget what the paper was, like a marriage certificate. But it's something that she holds dear to her heart. And Paul Rudd, at the end, just tells her, I mean, don't you think that if it's paper, don't you think it's just caught on fire? It's not here anymore. It's dust somewhere. And again, he says it, like, very, you know, with sympathy and with compassion towards the woman. And right then, you know, he develops a connection with her. And then as the movie goes on, you later find out that she's actually dead. You know, she's not there anymore. And so with that aspect of the movie where he has a moment with a ghost, or, you know, you think it's a ghost or whatever, that this movie has a lot more depth to it. And it definitely has a lot more depth to it. But then the movie tries to be like this, like, finding yourself avenue. I don't know. I mean, I really don't know how to explain what I'm thinking without just rambling on and on and on, practically about the same thing. But I give this movie, it's weird, I give it 2.5 out of 5 stars, but I'm kind of, I don't know, between 2.5 and 3 out of 5. It's really hard for me to say. I mean, there are some great moments in it, fantastic scenes with Paul Rudd and Emile Hirsch. They act very, very well. It's just, I think, trying to be two different movies when it's clearly the movie is one of the types, and that being not the surreal kind of trippy adventure film.
Basically, the movie, which is kind of sad, it tells a great story with great characters, and it does show a true development between these two complex characters that progresses the film and allows for this relationship to grow and change, and you get an appreciation for both characters. The problem is that it's kind of sad in a 94-minute movie. It takes too long. And due to the... I guess the best possible word here would be not esoteric, not existential, but... Oh, goodness gracious. Oh, my God. And I just used it for Ace Ventura. What the hell? Oh, my brain hurts.
It's all that alcohol.
Yeah, I'm...
And family time.
That's the word that... eccentric. Thank you. Good God. Brain kicked in, finally. The best word to use here would be eccentric. These characters, this relationship itself is eccentric and a little bit out there. And what I really did not like was when you had these already odd characters and already odd situations going on and the interaction between them, and then you would have a lull, and instead of progressing it, they would then shift to more of these eccentric shots that were, that basically, instead of trying to get them further along, if they had been by themselves in a regular movie, what I would have understood that. But instead, they add to an existing, already eccentric story. And instead of, in fact, adding, it takes away. And it's distracting and really hurts the movie, and I really kind of felt like it was more or less just filler. And so for that really hurt the movie for me. But the story itself was great, I thought, and the acting was surprisingly good. I really liked the chemistry between the two guys, and I liked the awkwardness that both characters had about them without realizing how awkward they truly were. So I give this one 3 out of 5 stars. I did like this movie. But that is all.
Come on, we got work to do. Let's go. Hey, open the door.
No way, Alvin. I'm on strike.
Open the door. We've got work to do. Let's go.
I said I'm on strike because you're being a crazy person.
Let's go.
Do you know the only reason that you have this job is because I was being nice to your sister? That's it. I was being nice, and I was giving you the opportunity to get your act together and straighten up. You quit acting so immature, learn a little discipline. But I don't have to be nice to you anymore, because I am not loved by your sister. She doesn't love me, so I don't have to love you. I could call the boss right now and have you fired.
Don't threaten me. You think you're so tough. I could beat you up.
You can't beat me up.
Oh, you want to bet? Look at you, calling me immature. You're just a worthless sack of crap.
Oh, yeah? Well, at least I don't go around thinking I'm a great dancer when I actually stink at dancing.
You never even seen me dance.
I've seen you do a lot of things when you don't think I'm watching.
There you go. So, where do you want to go next, sir?
Let's go with 300.
Very good, then. 300, Rise of an Empire, 2014 American fantasy warm film... Warm? God damn. American fantasy war film directed by Noam Muro. It is the follow-up to 300, of course. And this screenplay was done by Kurt Johnstad and Zack Snyder and is based on the unpublished Xerxes by Frank Miller. This one, of course, stars Sullivan Stapleton, Eva Green, Lena Headey, and, of course, Rodrigo Santoro comes back for a bit here, because, you know, he is a generous god. This movie is it is a sequel, but it's also a prequel and, I guess, parallel to 300, because it tells the story of things that led up to 300, the aftermath of 300, and things that were going on while 300 was happening. This is one of those movies, let's see here, it's been 7 years since 300, and quite frankly, I think this film came 4 or 5 years too late. It's, I mean, Eva Green's hot. She made a nice, convincing bad person. The movie itself is very interestingly shot, but, I mean, of course it's going to be relatively interestingly shot because it's in the style of Frank Miller and everything. I just... The acting was okay, but nothing really dropped me into it. I did like it. I mean, it was nice to share the experience with my dad. We went and saw this, you know, together. But... And watching it, I felt that it was all right. But all in all, the movie's just okay. There's nothing really outstanding about it. And just kind of felt like an unnecessary tits and togas flick. I don't know. For me, this movie's 2.5 stars. It's just okay. I think if you get the chance to check it out on Blu-ray or Redbox or something like that, cool. If you're into heavy-duty action movies and you just totally love 300 and you're just dying to see, you know, and you're one of those people who've been clamoring it for years, you're probably going to enjoy it. Even though I loved 300, I realized that and it was legendary for its time and very new, very visually exciting, really interesting way to tell the story and everything. I just felt like we have come past that now. There's a lot of cool stuff going on in the world of technology. There's a lot of cool ways to tell stories like this now, and they didn't strike while the iron was hot, and it was obvious, and I think they paid for it by waiting too long. So 2.5 stars for me. I don't know, Tim. Am I totally off base? Do you agree, disagree?
No, you're not off base far enough, I think. I'm sick and tired of movies like this. The freaking 12-minute long introduction with a British person explaining a movie where, for one thing, the movie is just a little over 90 minutes, if that. And they have all this introduction, which it could have been used without the introduction, like they actually could have used it in the story, in the actual narrative, for the story, more of the story to actually play out, you know, and maybe become more involved. Because why I don't like the original 300, and why I don't like, I prefer the first one to this one, it actually has something interesting going on for it. Other than this one, where it predominantly takes place on water, it has nothing new to offer at all, other than more shitty blue screen visuals where all these, like, the background, the CGI, you know, the only real stuff are the actors and the props that they touch, you know, their costumes and their swords or whatever. And everything else is CGI or blue screen. Maybe even parts of the boat that they're on is even in blue screen or whatever. And yet, they're in these treacherous waters. You know, I mean, they are in a not good... they're not in a pleasant atmosphere. There we go, that's what I'm trying to say. And yet, it just looks like another day at work for these guys. I mean, to me, there was no, like, actual harm or no real threat going on for them. And I just can't buy it. It has the narration at the beginning, which I was talking about or bitching about. And this type of movie just explains, you know, like, how you're supposed to feel. Like, this, the Greek god, or this god, Xerxes, and he's a sad man, but really, I mean, he's not only evil, he has been tempted by yada yada yada, and this has happened, therefore, the audience, you must fear this man, because I am telling you in this narration that you have to fear him. But then, there is a young warrior, blah blah blah, who wields a mighty sword, and hits the table with a mighty... just shit like that. And to where they create... verbally, they tell you. They talk at you the character. Yeah, there's just no, like, discovery with it. It's just everything's just thrown at you. And I just hate that. I hated it with this one. I hated it with the first 300. It's more about the special effects. They have the one of the worst sex scenes I've ever seen. Though Eva Green is a babe, and she is incredibly attractive, that's kind of all that I took from this movie, is that it solidified my thoughts on Eva Green being a complete and total babe. I didn't care for any of the action, didn't care. I mean, the blood and the gore and whatever was there just to be there. It really didn't add anything to anything to me. I didn't really notice any cool shots or any cool effects or any cool action that was being played out or whatever. It just force feeds you the information and it force feeds you your response. Like, if there's an awesome action scene coming up, you know it's going to be an awesome action scene because it's going to be in slow motion. And for some people, as I guess ever since The Matrix, you know that you're going to love an action scene if it's in slow motion. And that's, you know, what 300 is to me. It's just force feeding you stuff, telling you what to like. Not my kind of movie, you know. And I know there are a lot of people that really like the first one that are probably going to watch this one that are going to really like it as well. And, you know, it's just, you know, it's just one of those movies, I guess. I give this one 1 to 1.5 out of 5 stars. I wrote down 1.5 though, but I don't know why. It should be just 1 out of 5.
Well, strong words for the movie 300: Rise of an Empire, which just leaves us with Mr. Peabody and Sherman. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the 2014 American 3D computer animated comic science fiction film based on the characters from the Peabody's Improbable History segment of the 1960s animated television series The Rocky and Bullwinkle Show. This, of course, directed by Rob Minkoff, produced by Alex Schwartz and Denise Nolan Cassino, screenplay by Craig Wright, and starring Ted Burrell, Max Charles, Ariel Winter, Leslie Mann, Stephen Colbert, and Allison Janney. Okay. So Mr. Peabody is a dog, and he has his boy Sherman versus a boy and his dog, and he is a scientist and all-around Renaissance dog or what have you, who can inexplicably talk, and then has the Wayback Machine with which he goes to find out what really happened in history. That's the 1960s version. This one has a dog who is just like the most retardedly accomplished being on the planet, who adopts Sherman because he was abandoned. And then is therefore his dad. They use this rewrite or this redesign, this reimagining, I guess would be the best way to say it, of the relationship to create the impetus for the plot to occur, which is Sherman tries to impress a girl, and it's not really so much impressing the girl as it is trying to prove that he's not a liar when it comes to George Washington, and then unwittingly starts off a chain of events where he is changing history as it goes. Now, the movie itself is pretty evenly paced. It's a brisk 92 minutes. It is not boring. It's good family fare. Definitely very cute. Lots of little funny quips and stuff. They really and truly did try to keep the heart of the original shorts intact for this film, and I really appreciated that as a fan of Rocky and Bullwinkle growing up. However, I really wish they had done something other than trying to pass it off as he adopted him and they have an actual father-son interspecies relationship, because that kind of, like I said, that's kind of the impetus between the impetus for the entire plot of the movie, which ultimately has the bad guy of the film is actually played by Allison Janney as Miss Grunion, who is the bigoted children's services agent who doesn't think that a dog should be allowed to adopt anyone. Now, aside from what the people who would read way too much into stuff would say is trying to shove political correctness down your throat and all that stuff, I'm not subscribing to all that. I really think that they made this change so that you could act, so they could literally have the story, because without it, they wouldn't have had a movie. And I think that given the nature of the material, of the source material, they didn't have to go this route to create the plot for the movie. And that's the one thing that I wrestled with for the whole movie. The animation is great. The voice acting is great. Ty Burrell really does a great job. He really does embody the puns. He embodies the kind of the spirit of the character. And he does a really good job of recreating the voice, too. I was really impressed with that. I don't know. It just really bothered me that that was the way they chose to interpret the relationship. Instead of allowing it to have its nonsensical premise be the premise for the fun of the movie, which, again, they do great. They make great strides with that when they open up all the wormholes and the past is intersecting with the present. So they really do a great job with all that. I just don't think that they needed to change it to a father-son relationship in order to do that. And I'm sorry to keep harping on it, because I realize I'm going around in circles. For me, that was just the biggest thing to get over. It does not, however, affect the quality of the movie in terms of it being a good movie. For me, 3.5 stars. Very, very solid family film. Your kids are going to love it. There's no real innuendos or anything of that nature, which I thought was fantastic, because this one is for the adults in terms of just the actual characters themselves are going to completely remind you of everything that happened before, but the actual story and everything that is carried through in today's manner is great for the kids as well. Personally, the only thing that really draws it down is just the way that they changed the actual relationship to fit the plot of the movie, but it does not detract from the enjoyment of the film as a whole. So I liked it, and I definitely say I liked it a good deal. So 3.5 stars for me. Tim,
Right off the bat, I give it 2.5 out of 5 stars. I thought it had beautiful animation, and I don't know. I think that's really the only thing for adults. I mean, who are not originally, like, original fans of Mr. Peabody and Sherman? I'm sure as a kid, I watched or have seen episodes of when they were, you know, them being on Rocky and Bullwinkle, because I know I did watch Rocky and Bullwinkle, but I didn't go back and rewatch them in preparation for this movie. So I'm just kind of going off of, like, a fresh experience, or, you know, just a fresh start to the characters. And, yeah, I just really, I don't know, nothing really about the movie has a bite to it. Comedy-wise, especially. They have the father and son relationship, which they were Pixar-ing it a little bit, you know, trying to bring in heavier undertones to make it more engaging and appeasing to a family, or maybe people to learn something from it. I don't know. It's just trying too hard to bring the movie down to an emotional level when it was never really elevated to something light, fluffy, funny, you know, incredibly funny, to where, you know, it could have used a little bit of real life injected into the characters and the story and all that stuff, despite its relationship between a boy and a dog. Like I said, the movie has no bite. The jokes are cheap. I thought that the jokes mainly play on a elementary level. I mean, they play around with elementary history just to keep the kids engaged, I felt like. They go through various time periods, and they kind of rehash the same jokes. They use, it sounded like Patrick Walburton as the head Trojan guy. He looks and sounds just like Kronk, you know, from The Emperor's New Groove. It's just that's the same type of character that he even plays for the most part. I don't know, there just really wasn't anything fresh to this movie. I mean, I wanted there to be some jokes for adults, and I'm not saying anything raunchy or innuendos, but I thought they could have played with the history aspect just a little bit, other than it being a gag, you know, throughout the entire movie. They could have, I don't know, the movie could have just had more fun with it, instead of it focusing mainly on the father and son relationship. It really didn't have enough time to really explore other avenues and make it more of a an exciting movie to watch. And that's what it felt like it should have been. I mean, it's playing around with time. They're going to the French Revolution. They're going, you know, they're hanging out with Trojan. There's just so many things they could have done, and yet, you know, they didn't. Why? I don't know. I thought the movie moves too fast. Another reason why tags along with what I was saying, that the jokes are, you know, just everything just goes so quick and they breeze through time periods and scenarios that they really don't saturate themselves in the atmosphere. It's kind of like, oh, hey, let's show the next cool, you know, the next cool setting and the next cool scene and the next cool special effect or the next cool CGI, and let that be the reason why kids are loving, you know, enjoying the movie, because of cool stuff to look at, even in 3D, probably. I didn't see it in 3D. Instead of it relying on the story and the characters and even what the fan base is even used to. I thought the movie definitely had potential. Matt really liked Ty Burnell as Mr. Peabody. Again, I'm not familiar with the character all that much. I thought it was a lot of the characters were just one-dimensional in a way. Voice acting wise, not necessarily the scenarios or situations they were put through, but a plethora of things that just didn't really work out for me. But I definitely saw the potential, and there were aspects of it that I did enjoy. That's why I gave it 2.5 out of 5. I didn't hate it. I didn't love it. It's just, you know, it's just sitting right there, you know, right there in the middle. Good qualities, bad qualities.
And that's fair enough.
I got it!
What are you doing here?
We have come to take you home.
What's the Egyptian word for tattletale?
Mufshiasur. But that's beside the point. Get your clothes on. We're going home.
Who died and made you, Pharaoh? Now, bring on the mani-pedi.
See, Mr. Peabody? Impossible!
Penny, come here right now. Penny, come.
I'm not Penny anymore. Now, I'm Princess Hatshepsut, precious flower of the Nile.
Precious, perhaps, but if you think we're going to leave you here, you are most definitely in denial.
What's the matter, my sweet little desert blossom? Are these barbarians bothering you?
As a matter of fact, they are.
Bow, barbarians!
As you wish, Your Highness.
Who's that, Mr. Peabody?
King Tut.
My boyfriend.
King Tut is your boyfriend?
Mm-hmm.
Would you like me to have them skinned, covered with honey, and laid in a pit of fire ants?
You'd do that for me?
Anything, my desert flower. Consider it a wedding gift.
What? You can't marry this guy?
Why not?
Well, for one, his name rhymes with butt.
I don't care. I'm gonna have a big, fat Egyptian wedding.
Spoiler alert. King Tut dies young. Are you sure you've thought this through?
Oh, trust me. I thought it through. I'm getting everything.
All right, so the movies for next week are going to be Bronson, Europa Report, and FDR, American Badass. That's right, folks. We're taking a break from the flicks at the movie theater, and we're all going to go ahead and just watch Netflix movies. So feel free to join in if you're poor or just
don't want to go see Need for Speed.
Have nothing better to do. That's right. That's right. Now, are we going to bring back a three squared?
Yeah, I just couldn't. I couldn't think of a three squared.
All right. Well, we are going to bring back three squared, and oh, you know what? I have an idea for a three squared. Perhaps, maybe, just maybe, we can revisit the most controversial movies ever made for our three squared. All right. Well, very good. Okay. Now, we're looking for our second lot of picks for the most controversial movies ever made, and we'll do our best not to repeat our previous picks. So that's what we're going to be doing for three squared next week. And I believe that brings us to the spiel, does it not?
That is correct. Spiel on.
All right, let's do it then, folks. All right, so until next week, the music you've been listening to, as always, has been brought to you by our music partners, Cries of Solace. You can check them out at criesofsolace.com. You can also check them out at reverbnation.com, myspace.com, and facebook.com/criesofsolace. We, of course, are still the SLS Cast. You can go to our website, slscast.com. I can die here while I'm trying to say this. You can go to slscast.com. You can always send us an email to theslscast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter at theslscast. You can go to Facebook and find us there by searching the SLScast, or you can even subscribe to us on iTunes and favorite us on Stitcher. But until next week, this is Matt saying that thanks to Don Adams, I get to say this. I did movie star impressions as a kid in high school. Somehow, they just got out of hand.
Oh, Don. Take care, guys. See you next week.